All right, so the first part of the journey is almost over, and we asked Joe to tell us about the future.
Is my mic working? How about now? So everybody already got to see the eye charts. I'll skip that. Antonio was complaining earlier in the week that Americans don't speak any languages, with the possible exception of English, which I think is a valid criticism, but my rejoinder is that I'm going to give most of this talk in Latin. And then at the end, Antonio will provide the translations. There's also some Greek. There's the outline. They used to. It used to be the dominant paradigm, but now it's been replaced. Maybe relevant to this talk. There was a Higgs discovery. If you don't know that, why the hell are you here? Because part of this talk is recycled material from my talk in Barcelona, where I was pandering to the locals. So you all know this story, but I wanted to remind you of some things that might be useful to you in real life. For example, when you get home to your university, go print out a copy of Nambu's Nobel Lectures and nail them to the door of your office. You will not be sorry that you did this. You should also read them. They're really fascinating. It's a story about condensed matter physics and how it was the inspiration for his ideas, and in particular for this gigantic leap of taking condensed matter ideas and applying them to the vacuum. Another condensed matter tie-in, which is useful to remind members of your own departments of, is the fact that Phil Anderson in 1962, understanding this correspondence, asked himself the question, how come these other cases have Goldstone modes and superconductors don't? And he actually guessed the correct answer. And this, of course, was 2 years before Higgs and all those guys. So it pays to be a physicist that looks at real systems with insight. And then, of course, these guys put it together and understood this in terms of relativistic quantum field theory. And it's still, I think, really amazing that this actually is what's happening. There's a fundamental self-sourcing scalar field that spontaneously breaks the symmetry everywhere in the universe. So who is the guy in the front? This is Braut. And I didn't put the other people involved in this wouldn't fit on the slide. It's not that I'm aware of them. Another thing which Fabio pointed out at the Barcelona conference is that the Higgs boson is not just another particle, and it's not just the Higgs field. This particle is, of course, a force mediator, and in fact, it might be the dominant force between dark matter and baryonic matter, for all we know, and I'll get to that later. And it's not every day that you discover a new force, and if it's a fundamental particle, it's a fundamental force in some sense. So we sort of get caught up too much in thinking in terms of Lagrangians, but if you think of this in terms of particles, it's still an amazing discovery. So where are we now with the Higgs? Well, the first job of the experiments, which was the correct thing to do, was to figure out whether this was in any sense a Higgs or whether it was some kind of imposter. And that involves these rather challenging determinations of spin, of whether it's at least mostly a pseudoscalar, and then whether it looks like a particle from an SU2 doublet or something else. This is called the custodial test by the experiments, but it's not really a custodial test. It's what it is more like is a test of whether this particle is coming from an SU2 doublet or an SU2 triplet, which presumably would be part of the custodially invariant theory like Georgi Matschik wrote down many years ago. So all of these tests so far look like a Higgs. It could still be a dilettante imposter, as Jay told us, but you have to work pretty hard to do that. It could even be a spin 2 imposter, but nobody's going to believe that. So it's a Higgs, but that's not the end of the story, because is it the Higgs of the standard model? There are many, many Higgses. There's only one standard model. So it could be a mixture. It might be mostly a doublet, but it could be a mixture of other kinds of SU2 things. It could be a CP mixture. There could be extra particles going around in the loops affecting the couplings to photons and gluons. It could decay into exotic things like dark matter. There's all kinds of amazing things that could be going on, and we don't know yet whether any of this is happening or not. Furthermore, there's a long list of questions you can write down that connect Higgs to other things. And those questions themselves not only define an interesting program for Higgs physics, they define, in some sense, the whole program for high energy physics for the next 20 years. Here's a partial list of those questions. Is there a Higgs portal to dark matter? What's the origin of the electroweak scale? Does the Higgs sector have something to do with high energy instabilities like this famous vacuum instability? Is there electroweak baryogenesis having to do with the electroweak phase transition in early universe? How does the Higgs talk to neutrinos? Where neutrinos, where are they getting their mass from? And extra credit, if you answer all these questions right, is there some connection between Higgs and inflation or between Higgs and dark energy? And if so, what is that? So this set of questions, which is not a complete list, defines a multi-decade global experimental effort. And it's all three frontiers of high energy physics. It's not just what people usually call the energy frontier. It's everything, all connected with Higgs. The precision Higgs era has begun, I think. It's begun in the modest way of using some manageable number of parameters and trying to do these kinds of fits. But of course, as we get more ambitious and get more data, we're going to be doing much more ambitious things. And there were a couple talks about that, about what's the right way to do that, what's the model-independent approach that's sufficiently general but also manageable in order to do that kind of study. How much precision do we need? Well, you have some vague idea, at least, about what the experiments can do. There could be one or more large, where large, I think, for LHC means 10%, if you're going to convince yourself that it's for real. There could be such large deviations in the Higgs couplings versus the standard model. Not all of these would be detectable at LHC, even if they're there. If it's a 10% deviation in the Higgs self-coupling, you're not going to know that at LHC. But many of them you would actually know. If there are one or more large deviations, there's probably also smaller deviations, but you might need a linear collider in order to convince yourself that those deviations are there and extract meaningful numbers. So this could be a very interesting story, and it's of course connected with the fact that the LHC may produce other particles. In particular, if you have large deviations, that typically implies lighter new particles that are responsible for them, which should be at least many of them within the reach of the LHC. And in fact, it's an interesting question for the ILC, whether some of them might be achievable at the ILC. And of course, the thing to keep in mind is that you're not just extracting a bunch of numbers, it's the correlations between these deviations, it's the pattern that's going to tell you the underlying physics of what you're looking at once you start to see standard model deviations. One interesting thing, and this came out in the Barcelona conference, was that electric precision constraints already tell you interesting things about the Higgs couplings, other than what you get from the Higgs coupling measurements themselves. So for example, if you take what I think is the simplest parameterization for Higgs compositeness, and you compare that with the latest electroweak global fit that Silvestrini showed at LHCP, you find very strong constraints in that model. You find that the compositeness scale has to be bigger than something like 15 TeV. Now, of course, if you're a model builder, you can immediately get around this and do something more sophisticated. But it's showing you that you also get a very interesting reach from electroweak precision data. I think one of the biggest questions we have now has nothing to do with Higgs precision measurements. It has to do with how many more Higgses are out there. There may be other heavier Higgs bosons. There may be other lighter Higgs bosons than the one we have already found. I think those searches are just as important as measuring the properties of the Higgs that we have found, but they are very challenging. We know that there are cases of Higgses which are producible at the LHC in the sense that you will make them, but they are not necessarily detectable. And this, I think, is a big challenge for experiments and theorists to try and close some of those gaps and get better reach for the many heavy Higgses that might be out there waiting to be found. And especially embarrassing is the possibility that there's even lighter Higgs-like particles, lighter than 125 GeV, that we haven't yet found. So this was brought up in several of the talks. There are many interesting decay modes you can look for these heavy Higgses. Some of them, for example, involve the heavy Higgs decaying into the two light Higgs, two of the light Higgs that we have already found, or Higgs decaying into, heavy Higgs decaying into TT bar, the pseudoscalar decaying into ZH, decaying into gauge bosons. And some of these are more likely to be detectable than others, depending on what kind of extended Higgs sector you think these heavy Higgses are coming from. But they're all important, and we need to be able to have to extend our reach maximally in terms of this whole long list of different ways that the heavy Higgses could show up. And we had a nice example from Scott showing how you can have an analysis that you think is pretty general and has 100 different boxes and is not making a lot of model assumptions or any model assumptions, and you slice and dice the data this way and you think you've got sensitivity to anything that produces, in this case, 3 leptons, but it turns out that you have to slice and dice the data the 101st way before you would see this particular signal that's coming from a heavy Higgs decay. So it's showing that even though the experiments are doing a very good job of trying to do things in a way that does not assume a lot of theory input and also is as general as possible, it's not general enough, even for very basic things that we know we want to look for. Carlos also gave an example where you have a big parameter space in SUSY of heavy Higgses where you can have large branching fractions to electroweak enos. So these are not the case to standard model particles or even to the lighter Higgs, but to some exotic particle that we haven't even discovered yet. So having mentioned supersymmetry, let me now move on to supersymmetry, which was certainly the subject of many talks at this conference, and it's on a lot of people's minds. And let me remind you that supersymmetry is part of what has been the canonical, what I would say is the canonical BSM paradigm for some time now. And let me review that. So if you were to ask me circa 1990, what is BSM physics going to be? I would have said, well, any idiot knows that. There's SUSY, by which I meant natural SUSY, with some kind of solution for flavor problems at the weak scale. There's neutralino dark matter, as everybody knows. There's a grand desert, which isn't really a desert because at least sort of towards the high end, it has a few extra things thrown in there. I need something to break SUSY, presumably dynamically. I need to do something about neutrinos. Maybe I want to solve a couple other problems while I'm at it. Then there's gauge coupling unification with some beautiful SUSY gut, or maybe with something that's a little more stringy, but it's happening up at this very high scale. And then eventually Planck scale stuff kicks in and it's all string theory from there on, and we explain all outstanding problems of theoretical physics. So there's lots of good arguments for this picture. I bought this picture. I based my career on it, as many people have. I don't know any strong reason not to believe this picture. The arguments that are for this picture, I think, are still pretty much valid today. It's a picture which gives you a clear experimental program, what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to find a light fundamental Higgs boson, so we did that. It didn't have to be that, but we did find that. You're then supposed to find the superpartners and measure the heck out of them, so nail down their masses and their flavor and CP properties and start to get some idea of how that's working. You're supposed to nail down the extended Higgs sector. You're supposed to discover dark matter at colliders and in direct detection and in indirect detection, and then close the circle where you have a consistent picture of all that stuff and the large scale structure in the universe where we discovered dark matter and the early universe cosmology. So that's a big thing right there. You're supposed to understand what's going on in the neutrinos, in particular because they may have something to do with very high scales, other things that may have to do with very high scales like proton decay or charged lepton flavor violation. Then you're supposed to take this theory, the SUSY theory that you did, measured the heck out of it at the weak scale, and extrapolate it up to the high scales, and now you're going to all of a sudden get some idea of what the high scale theory is like, what kind of unification you have, maybe what kind of compactification you have if there's string theory in extra dimensions. And then you're going to have this triumphant theory of the high scale, which you're going to use to solve some of the big, deep problems that are remaining that have to do with really, really early universe cosmology, dark energy, black holes, whatever. So that's a pretty interesting program. Now, it's true that in step two, some people are getting a little nervous. I think this canonical paradigm may very well be correct, and if we start finding superpartners at the LHC, then of course the nervousness will go away, but we haven't found them yet. We already, in some sense, knew there was at least some kind of a problem with SUSY, because really, to tell the truth, in this paradigm, you would have expected to find the Higgs at LEP and to have found at least one superpartner at the Tevatron, and you didn't. So the only question is whether this problem, whatever it is a small problem or a big problem. Well, what's the status of superpartner searches? Well, I think it's too soon to tell. I think it's very hard to understand really where you are with SUSY, because of course SUSY isn't a model, it's not a theory, it's a thing that you put into models, so the parameter space of SUSY models is not even defined. So the best I can do is I can show you what happens when you scan in the largest parameter set of models that anybody ever does, which is what these PMSSM people do. So they scan through a 19 parameter space. And what they say is that they've excluded, using current LHC results, something like a third of the points in their model set. So, okay, you might have hoped that you found super partners in the first third, but you didn't. That's not the end of the world. It's also true that the experimental searches are complicated and very challenging. And furthermore, when you project them in terms of these simplified models, you see already this is an atlas plot that I like where they're doing overlapping searches here for, I think, stops. Is that what this is? It doesn't matter. So it shows you that you know, it's very complicated to really claim that you have any coverage in terms of finding a particular superpartner like this. And that's just in terms of simplified models. And then if you start to look at real models, things can get more complicated. And an example of that is what we saw in Graham's talk, where if you do something that doesn't seem like such a huge change, like having these Dirac Luinos, you can have big suppressions in the standard signatures, and it means you have to rethink how it is you're going to find these things. So that's completely plausible that there are some complications like that going on. But something else that has us somewhat worried is the fact that the Higgs, although it is light in the sense of 1 TeV, it's pretty heavy in the sense of SUSY, at least the SUSY models that we were using. And Howie mentioned this, and many other speakers mentioned this. And one way of saying it is that the sort of generic effect of 125 GeV Higgs is it is pushing you towards heavier superpartners. And in addition to that, if your favorite SUSY model didn't allow large mixing, you're probably in trouble because you're one of these guys. And it's the ones that do allow large mixing where they're able to sort of slough this off and say, who cares? Here are some plots that Legic showed us, which are not from the MSSM. They're from the constrained NMSSM, and even there you're getting pushed into these areas of large mixing, but still it's not that you're in bad shape. If you're living here, you're just above the current bounds and you're in a pretty good place for dark matter, so you're completely happy if this is where SUSY is. And Jonathan similarly showed us plots. These were in MSUGRA, good old-fashioned MSUGRA, in which you're completely happy if you end up in one of these regions in the sense that the LHC will eventually start to see superpartners, and everybody will be happy. On the other hand, there's also some more general nervousness about the whole idea of naturalness as applied either to SUSY or to physics in general. And part of this comes from the fact that some of us are old, and we remember things that people used to say 20, 30 years ago. And people used to give talks where they had pictures of superpartner spectra where this is the W mass. And that makes you wonder whether this is really a moving target or not. And the answer is it is a moving target, at least to some extent. So maybe there is some tuning going on here in SUSY. That doesn't mean that SUSY is wrong. Hitoshi, in his talk at Lepton Photon, had a nice, I think is a nice example of this, of how your theory can have moderate tuning, but it doesn't mean the theory's wrong. And he reminded us that in the 1990s, the standard cosmology model looked like it was in trouble. The basic Big Bang scenario looked like it was in trouble because they couldn't find the quadrupole anisotropy in the CMB, which is the first measurable anisotropy you could look for in the CMB. And the reason they couldn't find it is because it's abnormally small. We now look at these beautiful multipole pictures of the CMB, but the first point is really small for what, at least at the moment, appears to be just a no reason at all. It's just a coincidence. It just so happens that it's small. That's your tough luck. So these things happen, even in theories which are then beautifully vindicated later on. So if superpartners are found at the LHC, we'll eventually figure out what's going on. These small tuning issues, things that have to do with 1% tunings or whatever they are, we'll figure them out, I think. And that's true, I think, in SUSY. I think it's true if we find other kinds of new physics like Higgs compositeness. On the other hand, since theorists, I mean, part of your job as a theorist is to be a leading indicator. It's not to sit around and wait until things are conclusively figured out. It's you're supposed to be speculative. So it's not unreasonable, I think, to question whether this naturalness idea, which is in some sense the foundation of our mighty cathedral of beyond the standard model physics, might actually have shaky foundations. So as an intellectual exercise, you can ask yourself, how could the standard naturalness argument be wrong? how many different ways are there that it could plausibly be wrong? You want to translate this now or later? Very good. Very good. It means one thing I know is that I know nothing. Very good. Full credit. Okay, so here are all the ways that I was able to think of that you could imagine that the standard naturalist argument is wrong, or not the right way to think. Wrong is probably too strong of a word. So possibility number one is that the standard model is almost all there is. After all, the standard model, and even if I add things like dark matter to it, has the feature that it's a renormalizable gauge theory. It doesn't really have naturalist problems because at the end of the day, it doesn't have any cutoffs. There's some things you have to go out and measure to establish some mass scales, and then you predict on the basis of that. And it's a perfectly predictive theory, and as far as we can tell, it predicts everything correctly that we've ever measured. So the standard model by itself doesn't really have a problem, and even if I throw in some new physics, it still doesn't have a problem. The usual counterargument, there's two that I know of to this, is that, well, but we know that, in fact, there's a physical cutoff to the standard model, which is M Planck, where quantum gravity turns on. And that may very well be the case. I would guess that it is the case. But we don't actually know that that is the case, because we don't know anything about quantum gravity. We have a candidate theory of quantum gravity. We don't know if it's right. We don't know if we understand that theory. So this is a conjecture at this point. The other thing you can say about the standard model is that it has the seeds of its own destruction in the sense that the hypercharge coupling has a Landau pole at some super high energy. I don't even know if this is the right number, because nobody ever extends the plot out that far. But you could say, who cares? I mean, why should I worry about the fact that my theory doesn't work at an energy scale that nobody will ever probe? So that's one possible attitude. Another attitude is that there aren't any big tuning problems because there aren't any super high energy scales. 10 TeV is the ultimate energy scale, or 20 TeV or something like that. And that is sort of what you do in these Randall-Sundrum warped extra dimensions types models. You say, you know, the things that you thought, think of it in terms of big suppressions. The thing that you thought was a Planck suppression wasn't really a Planck suppression. It was a suppression by some much smaller energy scale, and then everything else was a wave function in the fifth dimension. So this idea of energy scales is tricky. Things are more complicated. You just don't understand what's going on. And really, the ultimate energy scale is 10 TeV, and you can't have any tunings that are worse than 1% or a part in 1,000 or something. Now, I think these warped extra dimensions models are a perfectly good framework. It's also interesting that if you're a warped extra dimensions person, you're not nervous at all yet, because you didn't actually expect the LEC at 8 TeV to find anything in your model. Because we already knew from electroweak precision and some flavor constraints that if these kinds of models are right, the stuff you're looking for is pretty heavy. So these guys, this is a pretty good framework. It's not really impacted by what we've done so far. That would be interesting if we start to find that. Possibility number three is that it's the multiverse stupid. Antonio? I'll explain that in a minute. So the basic idea here is that because of eternal inflation, which happens at super Planckian scales or something, there's 10 to the 500 different variations on our universe that we can't see, but they are physical. The electroweak scale is hierarchically small for anthropic reasons, or for reasons that have to do with the distribution of universes, and good luck in figuring out that. And so all this is very hand-wavy. On the other hand, if you apply this in what is claimed to be a minimal form, although I don't know that minimal has a unique definition here, it does lead to an actual model, some kind of semi-split SUSY or something, and those models are testable. So the good part of this argument, I think, is that you end up with testable models, and in fact, they're a field day for people that would do low-energy precision tests, because now you've got a whole Zepto universe worth of things to look at. So I think that's this part of this I like. This part of this I don't like, because even though I think the eternal inflation argument is plausible, this all sounds to me too much like what the Greeks called God from the machine, where your plot got too complicated, and so you just have God swoop in and fix everything for you. Now, the fourth idea is the one that's harder to explain, because it's really kind of an amorphous collection of ideas that haven't really gelled yet. So I need two slides for this one, but let me try to make some sense out of it. So for lack of a better name, I'll call this Bardeen naturalist, because Bardeen is the first person to talk about it. So maybe there's the standard model with some additions at the TeV scale, like dark matter. But then there aren't any explicit mass scales up to some very high scale. Then there's a UV completion, and I don't know what it is. The electroweak scale, like the QCD scale, is generated by dimensional transmutation. So far, I don't have any explicit mass scales anywhere. And now the whole question of naturalness has to do with how do mass parameters in this UV theory that I don't know what it is, how do they affect standard model beta functions? And do they, in fact, cause a quadratic sensitivity in those beta functions? And if the answer is no, you're done. But of course, you have to tell me what kind of a theory would do that. Now, another way, I think, to make this more palatable is to ask the question of where do scales come from in the first place? Not how do we make them in models, but how does nature make scales, which is a very different kind of question. We have part of the answer to this, the QCD scale. Thanks to David and others, we know where this comes from. It comes from dimensional transmutation, a very elegant method of generating a scale. What about the electroweak scale? Well, that one doesn't look so good. In fact, in the standard model, we put in by hand a tachyonic Higgs mass squared parameter. But nobody believes that this is what nature is doing. Does anybody believe that that's what nature is doing? Nature is not doing that. Nature is doing something more elegant. In fact, the obvious thing that nature is doing is the same thing here. Nature is actually generating the electroweak scale by dimensional transmutation. And in fact, in the standard SUSY models, this is one thing you always arrange to happen, because that's the obvious thing. This is just a kludge. So at that point, if I make a SUSY model or a non-SUSY model in which I succeed in generating the electroweak scale radiatively, now I have explained all known scales from dimensional transmutation, and I have a hierarchy of scales furthermore. So that's interesting. So nature so far is doing something very clever in terms of generating scales. So why would you then imagine that at 10 to the 16 GeV, nature just sticks in some super heavy masses for a bunch of adjoint Higgses of SU5? That's a stupid thing for nature to do. Nature has been doing smart things all the way up to that scale. So nature is probably doing something smarter at the high scale. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's all dimensional transmutation suitably interpreted at the end of the day. But that's the idea. Another way of thinking about this is to look at what we actually know from standard model couplings. And I guess the resolution here is not great, but I'll point it out to you. There's, of course, the famous thing we've known for a long time, that the gauge couplings run like this, and they don't really come together, but they kind of come together. So that's telling you two things. One, that's really interesting that they even kind of come together. It's also telling you you shouldn't take the numbers too seriously, because probably I left something out here that you have to put in to understand this in detail. What's happening with this is the new thing. This is the Higgs quartic self-coupling, which we now know, in the standard model at least. What does it do? Well, it's small, first of all. And then the other thing it does is it runs, and it runs from a small positive value, and eventually it goes to zero. It gets a little bit negative, but not very much negative. And in fact, if I kept going here long enough, it would get back to zero again. Another way of saying that is to plot its beta function, which is negative but small, and eventually goes to zero. So this is very interesting. This is telling you something. Again, I wouldn't take the numbers too seriously, just like I wouldn't take these numbers too seriously. But nature is telling you something here, and what is she trying to tell you? Another provocative way is to split this up and say, okay, we have for a long time said, look at this. I add SUSY thresholds, and I get, at the few percent level, I get actual unification of the gauge couplings. Well, look at this. This we've only known for the past year. We are sitting also at the few percent level at the boundary between stability and instability for the vacuum. So maybe this is a coincidence. Maybe this is a coincidence. Maybe they're both a coincidence. But you don't make a lot of money in science out of betting on things being coincidences. You make money by paying attention. All right, so that's the end of the philosophical portion of this talk. In the last few minutes, I want to talk about things that are somewhat more down to earth. So QCD is, of course, very down to earth. I think a lot of interesting things have been happening in QCD. We heard about most of this today, but I'll talk about one thing that we haven't heard about today. The first is, every time you hear a series of talks like we just heard, it kind of blows you away about the advances that we have, both in terms of our ability to do the calculations, and I think increasingly here, which I think is very important, is the increasing power of public automated tools that anybody can use, and not just for the standard model, but also for generic beyond the standard model applications. So this is a very, very, very important development. It's something that all of us should be aware of and taking advantage of, that these things are happening. And the other point is that, of course, we all know that the LHC program has already benefited enormously from this revolution in our ability to do perturbative QCD, but that importance is not going to decrease or even stay the same. It's going to get bigger as the LHC program goes on, for what I think are obvious reasons, as we're trying to look at larger data sets in more, with more precision and more detail. One thing we also heard about in the talks today is that as you do a better job in perturbative QCD, you eventually get to the point where you start to be embarrassed about the fact that you don't really understand the errors in parton distributions. And this, I think, is already a problem, and it's going to be increasingly a problem, and we're going to have to get more sophisticated there and sort of keep up with the level of advances that we're getting in the perturbative regime. And this was talked about also at LHCP. One of the obvious things to do is to start doing PDF extractions in a big way from LHC data itself. And another is to start to actually look at this trade-off between the fact that I'm able to do certain kinds of calculations with great accuracy and using that as a way to reduce parton distribution uncertainties in the places where they're poorly known. So we're going to have to sort of get that act together, I think, and the people realize that. And that's something that's starting to happen. One thing I don't think anybody talked about here was heavy ion physics. I think this, however, is extremely interesting. We see at the LHC some kind of excited non-equilibrium, strongly interacting state. It isotropizes very, very rapidly on this time scale, which seems awfully fast. It shows flow characteristics of relativistic hydrodynamics. It quenches jets, as you see very dramatically in the data. It melts quarkonia, which you also see very dramatically in the data. So this is the quark gluon plasma for sure, and it's had very dramatic properties. It's very interesting. This is the golden age of heavy ion physics. But you say, okay, I don't do heavy ion physics, who cares? We actually see, however, the quark gluon plasma-like features in PP collisions at the LHC, in high multiplicity collisions. This is the famous ridge that CMS discovered. So even if you never do a heavy ion collision, it's there even at PP. And there's a very interesting, I think, for theorists, very interesting theoretical challenges here. The sort of general one is, how do you get from a theory of gluons, or even a theory of QCD strings or flux tubes or whatever you want to call them, how do you get from that to relativistic hydrodynamics, which is the way this thing behaves? And then if you're a string theorist, this is a way for you to actually make a living, because it turns out that you can use perturbed black hole solutions in ADS-CFT as a toy model for this kind of out-of-equilibrium, strongly coupled plasma. So it's an example of a connection that wasn't anticipated, but turns out to be very useful. Now, this was also mentioned today, that we have made enormous progress in understanding the kind of physics to which you can apply NRQCD, and that's, of course, been happening sort of gradually now for something like 20 years. NRQCD is QCD, so it's right in some sense, but it does involve extra features that have extra properties. In particular, there's a factorization that then involves some kind of long-distance makeshift elements that are sort of like PDFs. We assume that they are universal, but that, just as with the PDFs, I guess, it was not entirely obvious. So you have to go test these kinds of things in data, and you have to see to what extent this thing actually works with these additional features that are built into it. So this has been going on for a long time, and we saw a lot of successes of that, but there are also failures, and the failures are very dramatic. So this is the latest CMS data that was shown at Barcelona. So this is for polarization, and this is in charmonium and bonomomium, and this is the data, and this is what you get from the theory, and they're way off, and this was also seen similar, qualitatively similar features were seen in Tevatron data by CDF. There's also, Atlas is actually doing associated production of Ws with J size, and they also see problems which might or might not be related. But this, I think, is really, really striking. I mean, this, here I took a theory that is actual QCD in some controlled, what I thought was a controlled expansion, and it doesn't agree with the data at all. Okay, and then the other down-to-earth thing I want to talk about is dark matter, because I think dark matter now is, for the next couple of years, especially with the LHC turned off, is going to be one of the most interesting places where we might get new information. So one of the questions we've been trying to nail down about dark matter is how does it actually interact with baryonic matter? And I just wanted to remind you that so far we only know that it interacts gravitationally, and maybe that's all there is. But if you want to have it interact in some other way, there's only two choices, because there's only two particles we know that you can stick plausibly into this diagram, and one of them is the Z and the other is the Higgs, which we have now discovered. And in fact, we know, as Catherine reminded us, we know it's not the Z, because in that case, direct detection experiments would have discovered dark matter a long time ago. If it's the Higgs, it depends, of course, on what the Higgs mass is. If the Higgs mass had been 500 GeV, which of course it could have been, then we would have been very sad, because it would have meant that direct detection via this Higgs portal was a long way off. But it turns out that with the Higgs that we actually have, this generically, so this is representing, if you like, sweeping over a bunch of models that have this sort of dark matter coupling put in, what you would expect generically is that we are just now, with the latest dark generation of dark matter experiments, getting to the place where we might detect these guys. So this is a very interesting Higgs connection that didn't have to be there. Maybe it's not there, but it just turns out that we're going to know about that within the next few years. And in fact, you can look at this in more detail, and you can scan, for example, over SUSY models that are viable SUSY models. So Leszek showed us a bunch of models like this. You can combine this, if you want, not just with direct detection experiments, but also with gamma ray. So this is indirect detection. This is CTA is a future thing that hasn't happened yet. So this is a projection. You can, of course, look at Fermi data, which does exist for this kind of thing. This turns out to be helpful if the dark matter is heavy. And so combining all this stuff together, you get this, again, very interesting interplay between models which are probable at the LHC. Some of them are not probable at the LHC. And then direct detection, which has some overlap, but not complete overlap, as you scan over these very large classes of models. So there's a big complicated story there that hopefully we're about to find out about. One other thing I want to say, almost in closing, is I want to, this is an actual conversation that I've heard many times, and this is the correct answer if you're an experimentalist. I want CMS to compare your data to this new class of models I invented yesterday, said to a not only experimentalist, but one that is completely swamped trying to get results out from Orion or whatever. On the other hand, some LHC analyses have provided extra information that actually allows theorists to recast limits for their own models with reasonable, good enough accuracy. And in fact, in CMS, we like to point out that we were pioneers in this. The same signed-day lepton search in SUSY, in fact, was one of the pioneers in this. So what do? You have a paper with a limit, but then in addition, you have a little section where you tell people how to essentially simulate what CMS sees for, in this case, leptons, in such a way that you can apply that to your own model. And if you know how to run MadGraph or PGS or something like that, you can do your own analysis. So that's a relatively simple example. This also is the case for some more complicated examples, like the RASER, which is something that I've worked on. So there, CMS is providing the background model, and then you have to generate your own signal Monte Carlo for whatever you think your signal is. But this can be done, and Leszek again showed us examples of this, where they actually reproduce these RASER limits very successfully. The other thing I should point out to you is that it's a lot of work for the experimentalist to put this together. So you put together a Twiki page and you validate that this all works, and you simplify your analysis to the point that a theorist can reproduce it. It's a lot of work, and they're not getting paid extra for that. So you should be appreciative. However, once you have this, you can do very interesting things. Tim Tate at Lepton Photon showed an interesting case where he took one of our CMS limits, and then he recast it into a more general constraint on dark matter models. And having done that, he was then able to overlay results from xenon in a meaningful way, and so get something to something that was far beyond anything the CMS people were going to do, because they're too busy to do this. It's not that they wouldn't necessarily know how to do it, but they're too busy, and that the theorists can actually do this. And another thing I wanted to point out is there are still many opportunities for theorists. You don't have to join ATLAS or CMS necessarily. many opportunities for theorists to get involved with helping the experiments find clever ways of improving their sensitivity, especially as you expand the number of kinds of signals that we're looking for and the challenge involved in those signals. And this was an example that Matt showed us, where he starts with an analysis, which is actually a pretty sophisticated analysis using this MT2 variable, which is a pretty fancy variable. And then he shows that he can make an even more fancy variable that gets significantly better sensitivity, in this case, to slepton production. So if you have good ideas, you should be pursuing them. The experiments will like you. Last but not least, I wanted to point out that we love the LHC, but we hope the LHC is not the last collider that anybody ever builds. And so when you make a big discovery, it's a good idea to think about what you're going to get out of this discovery. And it's not just a prize or a raise or something. You would like to get the next generation collider. And fortunately for us, due to the hard work of many, many, many people, there is a next generation collider that is actually on the launch pad, and somebody may actually make a decision and give the green light for it in the next year or so. And we should be so lucky that somebody wants to put an extra $15 billion into our field, and we should all be jumping up and down with excitement about this prospect. So, outlook. I think the Higgs discovery is just the beginning of a story that's going to be really exciting. It's going to be a story that bridges all the frontiers of particle physics, however you want to define them. It's not just precision measurements. It's going to be searches for new particles and phenomena, and I hope we find many new particles. It's going to connect, as I said, to the intensity frontier and cosmic frontier. So there's going to be a story here that's going to be a unified story, I think, for our field in that sense. And in particular, I think dark matter is going to be a really hot topic and a game changer potentially in the next few years. And I think whether the canonical BSM thinking is correct, I showed you if it's correct, we have a glorious future. If it's not correct, we also have a glorious future, because now we're going to figure out what we did wrong, and that's going to lead us off in some very interesting direction. So either way, I think we've entered a new age, and everything will be wonderful. So that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe, for this really very stimulating outlook, very positive outlook also. I don't know if anyone wants to top this by adding his or her thoughts. Normally we don't have questions. Oh, Carlos.
Does this have to do with the literature?
No, I was wondering, imagine that the Higgs and dark matter is all where there is. And Antonio wants to show this picture to his children, probably. And imagine we measure direct dark matter cross section, eventually, xenon or super CMS, whatever is coming. Now, how can we test that scenario? So then, is there any meaningful cross-section that we can measure at LHC to see the dark matter signals if it only couples to Higgs predominantly?
If it couples, so of course, if it's light enough that the Higgs
can... we are talking about the heavy dark matter.
If it's heavier, then if it's not too much heavier, you would hope to produce it in monojet-style production. So that's...
Have you estimated what cross-section that is?
I think actually this is something that is not known, and when we talk about the LHC upgrades, it's one of the things that I was pushing, but
yeah,
people said this is not, they weren't that interested in this. So what's the ultimate monojet reach with 3,000 inverse Fenton barns? It doesn't seem to be known. But that's an important question for precisely this region, because that's a model independent, if you like, reach estimate.
Everyone seems totally happy, and so I think we'll leave it at this point. Marcella has already thanked officially everyone here. I'd like to thank my co-organizers. It was a good team for this conference and for the workshop, and I'd like to thank all of you again for coming here, and have a good trip home. Thanks a lot.